Two men who in one way or another have dedicated their lives to the constitutional order of the United States, Hugh Hewitt and John Yoo. Uncommon Knowledge now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. With a BA from Harvard and a JD from Yale Law School, John Yoo has clerked for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the U.S. Department of Justice during the George W. Bush administration. Now a professor at the Bolt Law School at Berkeley, Mr. Yoo is the author of a number of books, too many books as far as I'm concerned. I have a backlog on my bedside table. A number of books, including his 2014 volume, Point of Attack, Preventive War, International Law, and Global Warfare. Also with a BA from Harvard, but a JD from Michigan, Hugh Hewitt has served as a researcher and writer for former President Richard Nixon, as Assistant White House Counsel and Special Assistant to the Attorney General during the Reagan administration, and as a partner in prominent Southern California law firms. The host of the Hugh Hewitt Radio Show, a top 10 talk radio program, Mr. Hewitt also teaches constitutional law at Chapman University. John and Hugh, thank you for joining me. Special carve out for you, Hugh. I know you're suffering a very bad cold, and it is good of you to join us.
Direct most of your questions to John, that way it won't sound so bad.
Hey, by the way,
my voice just sounds bad by itself without any help.
Hugh Hewitt, Harvard class of 78, John Yoo, Harvard class of 87. Just before we get to the Constitution, what does Harvard make of the two of you? Two of the most prominent conservatives in the country.
Well, both Harvard and Michigan have never invited me to the campus.
Oh, a little hint.
So I don't think they actually think much of me. How about you, John?
I have to confess, I just had my 25th college reunion. They had me on a panel of alumni who've been in politics. So it was just all war stories. But I was surprised, actually, that they were so welcoming. Of course, they asked me for money right after the panel.
At least not before.
To correct the record, I've done almost every 5 years a panel with Deval Patrick, Mark Guerin, and Grover Norquist. All of us graduated at the same time. Oh. So Grover and myself against the governor and the former communications director of the White House. But that's all alumni stuff, nothing formal. They're embarrassed.
All right, Obamacare, King versus Burwell. This is the case the Supreme, as we tape this, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments just about 48 hours ago. At issue, seven words in the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, a piece of legislation that runs to roughly 2,000 pages. A section of the law says that government subsidies must flow to health insurance customers, quote, through an exchange established by the state, close quote. Since more than 30 states failed to establish exchanges, the IRS disregarded the language of the law. This is not in dispute. This is not contentious. The IRS disregarded the language of the law to hand out subsidies through a federal exchange instead. Okay. Challengers argue the IRS broke the law. The government's claim, in the words of Solicitor General Donald Varelli during oral arguments, the challenger's interpretation, quote, revokes the promise of affordable care for millions of Americans that cannot be the statute that Congress intended, close quote. John, who's right?
I think the challengers are right. But first, let's say there's no constitutional issue here, unlike 2 years ago, about whether the government could even pass Obamacare and impose it on the American people and the states. This is just a question of reading what Congress wrote. If you read, you just quoted the statute, if you read it and apply what the words of the statute means, it says no subsidies for anyone in a state that didn't set up an exchange. The government's claim is really one of don't enforce the law as it's written because it would lead to a terrible result. The consequences are so bad, it must be a mistake. It was a drafting error. It's absurd to think that the statute would mean what it says. This can only happen if there's no real reason. It's totally irrational. So, for example, a statute that said build the bridge in this from point A to point B, and there's actually no line that connects point A to point B, then you would say, that's so crazy, Congress could have meant it. Here, I think the government has a big problem because there's a very rational reason to write the law this way, which Professor Gruber at MIT explained at length in many TV appearances and public appearances.
Professor Gruber, who participated in the drafting of the legislation.
He was calling himself the primary architect of the law when he was out giving speeches about it, which is And I have to say, I just taught a case in class this week that's identical to this case, which first set up unemployment compensation laws in the United States, which is the government wants the states to take the primary responsibility for running these exchanges. So they put a huge carrot in front of them. And they said, if you set up the exchanges, you get a massive amount of money. And if you don't, you lose
you
out.
Forgo that money.
And that's perfectly rational because, in fact, the federal government does this all the time in spending laws.
Okay, Hugh, listen to this. This is an exchange that took place during oral arguments. Justice Alito, if the challengers win, quote, it's not too late for a state to establish an exchange, so going forward there would be no harm, close quote. Solicitor General replies the suggestion is, quote, completely unrealistic, whereupon Justice Scalia comes in and says, quote, what about Congress? You really think Congress is just going to sit there, close quote. The Solicitor General comes in and says, this Congress, question mark, and there's general laughter. If there are two justices on the court who understand the difference between reading the statute and concerning themselves with the consequences of the court's decision, it is Mr. Justice Alito and Mr. Justice Scalia. And yet Alito and Scalia themselves seem to feel compelled to enter into a discussion about the consequences of the court's decision. What is going on in that chamber?
Well, I would, I'd love to hear what John thinks about this. I think this is an argument for the Chief Justice's vote. And as you'll recall, Peter, in our White House days, the Chief Justice was
down the hall.
Down the hall in the suite with me, and you were down the hall in the suite with the speechwriters, and the Chief Justice is very smart. So they're arguing over the mind of the Chief Justice as to whether or not he can be persuaded that it is not the destruction of the court and the legacy to strike this down. Because the left is saying, woe unto us if John's perfectly executed summary happens and they strike it down. Woe unto us. 7 million people will be thrown off of Medicaid. They will have no care. Justice Alito raised the possibility of a stay of the decision so that there'd be 8-9 months.
Right.
And Justice Scalia said the Congress will act, and the Solicitor General did what the Solicitor General should do, cast doubt upon that. And the Chief Justice sat back and waited. There's a part of it, though, that's interesting called Chevron deference. And I don't want to get too deep into the weeds of the law here, but
thank God.
Yeah, well, I know. It's a worse doctrine going. But how much do we let agencies do this? And
right.
Unfortunately for the Republic, we have increased the amount of deference exponentially over the last many decades. So there's an argument at 30,000 feet lurking behind here is, are we going to give again more power to bureaucrats to decide what laws mean? That's a big struggle. So there is a statute to be determined, but there's also an approach that will be decided.
Okay, so do you agree with Brother Hugh here that the Chief Justice, as with whom you, Hugh and I occasionally used to play basketball, had I known?
If you want to call that basketball.
If you want to call that basketball.
I bet you slammed
way,
over
what,
him over all the time, though, Peter. You're doing all kinds of reverse
white men,
dunks on
white
him
men
and everything.
Cannot jump, as we established that. We established
0-10 in the Alexandria City D-League, yes.
So, but do you accept?
But you could do tippy-toe.
Listen, I know you do accept, so let me just, the notion that the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court is not, they are arguing over him, Scalia on one side, Breyer on the others, they're arguing over him, over his mind, about questions of what this will do to the image of the court. This is not lawyerly disputation. Mm-hmm. They're saying, John, Mr. Chief Justice, don't worry, this is going to be fine even if we...
Yes.
Is that what it has come to, that John Roberts has turned into Warren Berger?
I think they're fighting the last war and not the current one. The last war was 2 years ago. Chief Justice Roberts reportedly voted to strike down Obamacare because I think, and this was the correct view, I think, that it went beyond Congress's taxing, spending, and Commerce Clause powers. Chief Justice Roberts reportedly switched his vote in the course of the few months afterwards because of all the political pressure that fell all over him. Now, the problem is, there's a Churchill line about this I can't remember about.
He caved to political pressure. Do you buy that?
No, I don't. I am one of the few dissenters who believe the chief actually clung to the doctrine, if there's any way to save the law, I will save it. And therefore, the taxing power came up. He did. I know that many people find that very skeptical. But I think he does act with, and it's not inappropriate to act, with the future of the court in mind. But I do believe there is this doctrine that if you can save a law, John, am I right? If you could save a law, you have to save a law. And he
I just don't think you could save
which,
it.
Which, yeah, leads to, which leads to...
But
which
he was thinking as an instant... I agree. He was thinking in the what he thought was the best political interests of the court vis-a-vis the president and Congress. My instinct is you're on the Supreme Court, so you don't have to think about that stuff. Decide what's right. let the politics take the consequences. If he was not the Chief Justice, I bet he would not have thought about that at all. But he thinks he's the Chief Justice and that he has a special role. I wish he wouldn't think that way, but he probably does, and that's why Scalia and Alito are arguing that way.
Okay, yeah. One other exchange during oral arguments, and you're going to have to you're going to have to be kind to me on this one. What was Justice Kennedy doing? He said to the plaintiff, he said, you may prevail. Let me see if I can find
Mike
the quotation.
Mike Carvin, the plaintiff.
Exactly. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Perhaps you will, this is Justice Kennedy to Michael Carvin, quote, perhaps you will prevail on the plain words of the statute. Now, according to you and Hewitt, stop there. Plain words of the statute, we're done. No. But there's a serious constitutional problem, Justice Kennedy continues, if we adopt your argument. Close quote. What is he talking about?
Well, let me speak a word in his defense. He is a genuine Federalist. He does and has a long history of writing in defense of the states and their authority and how they cannot be coerced by the federal government into doing things. So the point he is raising there is that this would be profoundly coercive of states if we interpreted it the way that the government is interpreting it. And so,
which was John's John laid it out that the government offers them an enormous carrot.
Enormous
and
carrot.
Says, if you don't do our will, no carrot.
And the first time that's ever been upheld was 2 years ago. The spending clause was actually invigorated we're all kind of stunned by that. So I think it's a genuine concern, and I don't know how it works to strike down the federal exchange. It could work to strike down the state exchanges, but I honestly do not know what he was attempting to communicate there, John.
Yeah, there's two possible outcomes. One is, this is the least activist thing to do, is read the statute as plainly as it is, and if it violates the spending clause, then strike the law down on the spending clause. But to take a law and twist it and turn it into something it's not, to avoid a constitutional problem that may not even be there, right? Kennedy's not saying, I know it violates the spending clause. He's saying it might. And there are reasons why it doesn't. There's never been, I think, a case where a statute's been mangled up just to avoid reviewing its spending clause implications, because that would mean we'd have to rewrite every spending clause,
every
spending of federal dollars, of unemployment insurance, Social Security. These are huge areas where a lot of money is given to the states and they cooperate in programs they may not like just to get the federal money. Is the Supreme Court really going to redo all the federal welfare programs?
It's very accepted for the federal government to bribe the states. That's what they did with the speed limit. And for your audience, they'll understand that the federal government would pass enormous incentives to lower your speed limit to 55.
Right.
And they threatened to cut those off if you didn't do so.
Right.
And everyone said, okay, it's their money. It's a bribe. And the federal government can bribe the states. What Justice Kennedy has a long history of genuinely doing is saying you can only bribe so much. And that, at that point, it goes from being bribed into being coerced.
Coercion.
Tony Soprano is living in your living room and he's running your sporting goods store. That's no longer a bribe. That's a threat of violence.
Okay. I'd like to get to another couple of issues here. So let's close this one out. John, you said there's really no constitutional issue here. But if I may, we've been hearing for days now that if the court sides with the plaintiffs and strikes down this aspect of Obamacare on the plain language of the statute, there will be terrible consequences. Let me put it to you the other way. Mm-hmm. If the court sides with the government, that's a clear constitutional development, is it not? It will be codifying the ability of a relatively low-level lawyer at the IRS to substitute his judgment for the plain language of a statute passed by both houses of Congress and signed by the President of the United States. That's fundamental. Or am I just being a layman who isn't sophisticated in his thinking about this?
You're much more sophisticated than many law professors who've commented on this case. And I couldn't put it better than that, but maybe put it in context. It's ratifying a much bigger phenomenon, which we ought to be concerned about, which is this is a tiny species of what the Obama administration has been doing in immigration, education, welfare, which is Congress passes a law, they don't like it. Now, they could say, we think it's unconstitutional, so we object. But they're not. They're just saying, that's a bad idea. We could do better. And we're going to rewrite the law and enforce only the parts we like or don't like. So that's the real danger, is if Justice Kennedy does decide to go to the liberals, he's actually putting his stamp on a kind of unilateral lawmaking, which he's actually criticized heavily in many other cases.
Hugh, call it. How's the court going to vote?
They're going to strike down the government's interpretation of this.
They will.
There's no
Despite
way
Despite his
it.
Musings from there, the bench, Justice Kennedy.
There is
Kennedy.
No way to uphold it, unless you wish to empower, as John just said, every bureaucrat with the right to rewrite the law. It would be the triumph of Leviathan if they don't strike it down, because every agency would then use notice and comment to extend their power to whatever they thought reasonable. It would be a very bad result the other way.
John?
I agree. I think it's going to be 5-4, because the striking thing is, and this should not go without comment, is the four liberals always vote as a block on every case as an ideological team. No one in the press criticizes them for this.
That's
no
true.
One criticizes them
That's
for
true.
They do not have an open mind about politically important questions, and they should. There was just a case, a very funny case, about whether when you throw a fish back into the ocean, you've committed a federal crime by throwing away evidence that you might have violated the law. And Justice Kagan wrote this opinion, says, when it says you can't throw away records or other tangible things, it means other tangible things, which is anything,
including
a fish. And now she can say, oh, no, we've got to read exchange by state to mean any kind of government.
Right.
So they're the four liberals to vote this way are throwing out their own principles on how to read the law to get an ideological result.
We were talking about lawlessness or unilateralism on the part of the administration, the deal with Iran. Article 2, Section 2, Constitution of the United States, quote, the president shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties provided 2/3 of the senators present concur, close quote. Sometime this spring, March 24th, if Iran abides by the deadline, if they can pull it off in time, President Obama will reach a nuclear agreement with Iran. Under a correct reading of the Constitution, should the president be required to submit that agreement to the Senate? He has said that he will not. Should he?
I do not think so.
John?
I think it's a very complicated question. It really depends on what we agree to do. If
we,
the United States, agree to do with Iran, if Iran just says, we're going to do all these things, and you, the United States, don't do anything, then I don't think you have to submit to the Senate or Congress, because we haven't actually obliged ourselves. But the idea is, the leaks that you hear about what we're promising to do, I think it's got to be submitted to Congress. If we sign an agreement not to attack Iran, some kind of non-aggression idea, that's got to be done. If it's some kind of arms control agreement where we agree to some kind of verification process and we take on certain obligations, every arms control agreement ever signed by the United States, except one temporary one, has been submitted to the Senate as an arms control treaty. Or if we agree to lift sanctions, then either you submit it to the Congress or the sanctions aren't going to get lifted, because the president can't lift sanctions on Iran unilaterally anyway.
Hugh,
was it wrong for George W. Bush to unilaterally abrogate the ABM treaty?
No, I do think presidents have the right to terminate treaties. That's right, goes back to the Nixon years, actually, and before. So I think it actually sets up this very interesting problem, which is, if you're Iran, what do you want? If you're Iran and you sign this deal, you want Congress to agree, because President Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush could terminate it. So you want to see Congress pass a law lifting sanctions permanently. Otherwise, you don't think you're really getting anything permanent.
Can I put to the two of you, let me just put a scenario to the two of you and have you comment on it. This isn't even a question. It's just a kind of bundle of thinking. I was in Washington 10 days ago. We almost overlapped with each other. And at an event where there were a couple of, well, it was more or less off the record. So there were a couple of journalists and a couple of members of the United States Senate present at this. And they were trying to think it through. And they began, I think we can stipulate this, they certainly did stipulate it, that any agreement that permits Iran to achieve a nuclear weapon is simply unacceptable. So what do they, in their duty as members of the Senate, do? Item one, they thought that the Republicans should move Menendez-Corker, which is a bill sponsored by a Democrat, Menendez of New Jersey, that would scream out, cry to the heavens for the president of the United States to submit it to the Senate. Nobody believes the president would submit it to the Senate, but they want the Congress on record as saying, let us have a role. And then they were thinking through presidential candidates, Republican presidential candidates, should say, sorry, he didn't submit it to the Senate. This is a matter of the highest solemnity. He does not have the right to bind the country. This is a deal between Barack Obama and Iran. I, Jeb Bush, or I, Ted Cruz. This was, Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz were not present. But the candidates should say, if I am elected president, I have the right under the Constitution and before my conscience to re-examine that deal and repudiate it if I believe it in our national interest. Comment.
I think they're accurate in what they should do. I also believe that they could do other things in the interim, including using the power of the purse to abrogate the ability to implement the treaty. Mm-hmm. They can deploy more troops. They can do all sorts of things. The president can veto it. What I go back to is the foreign affairs power of the president is immense, and I don't want to limit it. I believe in the unitary
executive.
I don't want to limit it. If you're going to make bad deals, presidents make bad deals all the time. Sometimes they make good deals. They give destroyers to Churchill when Britain's in its darkest hour without congressional assent. So I'm very leery about saying that the president ought to have to go to Congress. But Congress can do what it wants in response to this.
I fully agree with that. And I'd say there are two things that go beyond this, which Congress could do. Why worry about whether it submits an agreement or not to the Senate? The Congress should just impose mandatory sanctions on Iran that are higher than ever we've put on them. Cut them out of the international banking system. Cut them out of international trade. Impose an oil embargo on them. Don't let them export oil into the Western system. If you really wanted to ratchet up, the president doesn't have the power over foreign commerce. Congress does.
You who worked with and became devoted to a man who suffered through a constitutional crisis, do not shrink from the notion that there's a constitutional crisis brewing. Your view is let it come, let Congress do what it wants to do. Is that right?
Well, Lincoln, and then the war came. And then the crisis came. I want to point out, it would be so easy for the Congress to strike back, so easy, because they have a veto-proof, apparently, majority to do so. They could even grant citizens standing to enforce sanctions if they wish to go hog wild on enforcing sanctions. They could do all sorts of innovative things to drive Iran to its knees. It's up to them to do it, though, not the president.
And increase military spending back way above Obama recommended
levels.
Get
out of the sequestration.
And rebuild the Navy and Air Force in that can strike in that region.
Okay, the president and Congress, the use of force. Responding to ISIS, last year the president ordered American warplanes to begin bombing targets in Iraq and Syria. This is 6-7 months ago. It's been going on for a time. In February, he submitted to Congress a request for an authorization to use military force, or as everybody in Washington calls it, because there's no such thing as too many acronyms, an AUMF. The president's request would limit operations to 3 years and would rule out, quote, quoting from the request, enduring offensive ground combat operations, close quote. Let's come to the substance of the AUMF in a moment. First of all, what is he thinking? He's been at war with ISIS for 6 or 7 months, and now he's requesting authority. Why?
So this, to me, is really an attempt to bind his successor's hands. If he wants to not have any ground combat operations, he's the commander-in-chief. He can ensure that for the rest of his presidency. So what you have is a remarkable, unprecedented, I've read every authorization to use force. I've written some or drafted some of them. This is the first time a president has gone to Congress and say, infringe on my commander-in-chief authority. Take away my tactical and strategic control over the armed forces. Do something unconstitutional to my commander-in-chief authority. Never happened before. Why would Obama do this, who's, on the other hand, flying drones around, dropping bombs on people outside the Afghanistan-Iraq region? Why? Because he doesn't want President Clinton or President Jeb Bush or President Ted Cruz to be able to conduct military operations. So this has been the story of his presidency. While we all look at a lot of these things he's done and claim the executive power is out of control, in foreign affairs, he's actually been reducing it, decreasing it in line with his effort to decrease America's role in the world. And this is just another example of him trying to harm the presidency permanently in our foreign affairs.
You subscribe to that?
That is exactly right. Senator Cotton on my radio show said it should be called a restriction on the use of military force, not an authorization on the use of military force, because it does attempt to limit the next president in his or her operations. And If they actually just passed it through, by a mistake on a transom, it's unconstitutional as can be. He can't bind his successor against the Constitution. But I think John has completely and accurately stated his motive and his reasoning.
Okay. What about the Epstein response? Richard Epstein, our mutual friend Richard Epstein, has said, wait a minute. Congress should ignore this request for an authorization for the use of military force and do what the Constitution quite explicitly authorizes it to do. Send him a resolution of war. It's even a good constitutional question, says Richard, whether the president's signature is it's a good question whether he could veto it if he wanted to.
Doesn't actually have to sign the declaration.
So is this another instance where we just are waiting around for Congress to find some resolve and boldness?
The president runs the war. And so I understand why Congress is hesitant to tell him what to do. They don't have access to the information. Even people like Mike Pompeo, they don't have the intelligence. I would I would agree with Professor Epstein to this extent. They should not pass this. I don't think we need a declaration of war, the president's inherent authority, to strike under the old AUMF, I think. John, do you agree with that?
Yeah. I think Congress can only make things worse at this point. And even if you were Richard and you thought Congress has to declare war
Richard
before
Epstein,
a presidency,
right?
Face it. My colleague Richard has this view. There already is a 2001 and a 2002 AUMF, and they both apply. The 2002 one, which goes overlooked, says the president's allowed to use force in Iraq to stop national security threats coming from Iraq. I don't know what ISIS is other than that by definition. Now, the thing we should note is, again, it should be stated that President Obama, in his great foresight, was asking for these two authorizations to repealed as recently as last summer. Just shows you how much foresight he had into the actual foreign policy national security threats facing our country.
We won. Didn't you know that, John? Okay, two quotations. This broader question of lawlessness or unilateralism. I think that's probably a better formulation. Unilateralism. Two quotations. One, President Obama last summer, quote, middle-class families can't wait for Republicans in Congress to do their stuff, so sue me, close quote. He's talking about, actually, there are so many things he could have been talking about, it doesn't matter. Senator Ted Cruz, also this past summer, quote, of all the troubling aspects of the Obama presidency, none is more dangerous than the president's persistent pattern of lawlessness, his willingness to disregard the written law and instead enforce his own policies via executive fiat, close quote. So the general point, I'm assuming that the two of you lean heavily toward Ted Cruz's interpretation of this, right?
Yes, I do.
John, lawlessness?
Only with what he's been doing domestically. I don't think President Obama's been lawless in foreign affairs, but domestically.
I agree with that.
Okay, fine. So we'll stipulate that from this point on, we're discussing purely domestic matters. Can you address this question of, excuse me, President Obama said, so sue me. And the House of Representatives has done just that. There is a suit underway to sue him for his immigration, his unilateral decision to permit some 4 or 5 million. The amazing thing is nobody can even count how many people it applies to, but some millions of people. And even on our side, so to speak, the conservative side, there's much commentary in the Wall Street Journal saying this is a terrible mistake, it's unconstitutional, the wrong way for the House of Representatives to go. And underlying all of this is the question of standing. The president gets to do what he wants to because nobody has standing to bring suit. How can it be that the president behaves lawlessly, harming everyone who lives in the constitutional order of the United States, which is to say every American, and yet no one has standing to bring suit? Could you just explain that to me, to an exasperated layman, John?
Actually,
because I hold you responsible, actually.
I actually agree with Justice Scalia and the conservatives on standing generally, because I do think, and you guys who are in the Reagan administration should remember the days when the courts were second-guessing every decision by the executive branch. We don't want to go back to that world. And that's partially what standing does, is it gets the courts out of being the third house of the legislature. That's what Justice Scalia called it. But there is a way to sue. It's just Congress isn't the right body. And the successful suit that is going forward and I think has standing is the states. Because the interesting
thing— The state attorney general.
There's this case going on in Texas where the district judge just, I think on the wrong grounds, but I think properly the end result was he stopped President Obama's immigration order because he said Texas and a lot of other states are forced to treat the people who are allowed to stay under Obama's order equally with citizens. So that means they all get a driver's license. They all start getting benefits under state law. And so they've been harmed. And that's appropriate. I think states do have the right to sue. The reason congressmen and congresswomen can sue is because they have a way to affect their views, which is they're members of Congress. They should get off their butts and pass laws to counteract what President Obama's doing, whether it's cutting off funds or whether it's changing the law in certain ways.
By the way, the two of you are so basically unimpressed by the leadership in the House of Representatives, which has had a Republican majority for 2 years and 2 months now, and so far by the leadership in the Senate, which has now had a Republican majority for a couple months. Is that right?
Well, I'm sympathetic to the difficulties of governing, but I do point out that what John just said is absolutely true there. The side effect of President Obama's lawlessness, and I use that all the time, is that he's invigorated the state's attorneys general. Scott Pruitt in Oklahoma, Mark Brnovich in Arizona, Cynthia Kaufman in Colorado. These offices never used to attract much attention. Now they do have standing, as John was just laying out, the Texas lawsuit with 24 other states to block the president's direction, he didn't actually sign an executive order, his direction to his Secretary of Homeland Security to move forward, it's a very good thing. It's a great thing. They're the right people. They've been injured. And so they've had, I don't like gimmicks, and the lawsuit was a gimmick, an attempt to respond to the most amplified voices that are anti-illegal immigration in the United States. And I think that was a mistake. But it is a good thing that the state attorneys generals have stepped up because they often do have standing, as John just described.
Can I just mention one point?
Of course, sure.
President Obama, what he's doing is actually destroying the presidency in the long term, because no Congress in the future can trust presidents to exercise the power they have. Because if you can't, if you're Congress, you write a law, you delegate power in immigration, even if they pass some immigration law that both of us liked, how do you know the next president's not going to change the numbers on you? And so it means Congress is just going to make it harder and harder for presidents actually to get Congress to trust
the
them
long
again.
View. Let's pursue that. The long view. Hugh, you worked with then former President Richard Nixon, who of course was accused over and over again of being lawless. On that question of lawlessness, contrast Richard Nixon with Barack Obama.
Well, I'm beginning to think that Hillary makes them both pikers, but given the email scandal. But what President Nixon did with impoundment, which was struck down, what he did with the plumbers and what happened in the obstruction of justice are clearly led to the imperial presidency by Arthur Schlesinger. So it was not a happy time for the rule of law in the United States. And I'm an admirer of President Nixon. I understand a very complicated reason why it happened. But President Obama has systematized and expanded and indeed made it not only a recurring theme, but something to be admired among the left to break the bonds of trust with the legislature, which is a very long-term problem that John just alluded to, which is no one trusts President Obama on Hill. Nobody trusts him. And so that will carry
over. When you
over.
Say nobody, you include many Democrats.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. So how serious long-term problem? I think I'm quoting you back to yourself. What can be done? What's the next president to do?
This is a hard problem because there has to be some discretion in the executive branch. And I think President Nixon actually gets a bum rap in that he did institute a lot of incredible domestic reforms to try to rationalize the crazy Great Society and all its, you know, rickety programs and conflicting mandates that LBJ and the Great Society Congress had passed. So there has to be some discretion for presidents. And President Reagan was actually probably the most effective president in trying to stop wild regulatory growth, make things rational. We're just having a conference at Hoover just right before the show about how do presidents do that. They get through the Office of Management and Budget in your time in the White House. So it has to be that flexibility. And so what the next president has to do is to say, you know, you can try, we still have to work together to stop the burdens that the regulatory state's placing on the economy. But I'm going to go back and I'm going to repeal every one of President Obama's executive orders. That's what he could do. Day one, let's start with a fresh slate to prove that I'm trustworthy. I'm going to repeal every executive order that President Obama put out, and I'm going to start working with Congress to make sure we have some consensus that we're going to go forward. That's the minimum, I think.
Oh, really?
Democrat or Republican.
That doesn't set in motion a kind of long-term tit for tat?
I'll repeal his
executive orders, then will repeal mine.
Because then he'll say, and in these areas where President Obama went too far, I'm going to invite the leaders of Congress to sit down with me, and we are going to try to come up with orders that reflect a consensus between our two branches, which the president may lose on policy, but he's got to do it to restore trust in the office. Otherwise, our system cannot work unless there's cooperation between the branches.
I wanted to go there. We may be seeing the eclipse of the republic. I'm not an alarmist. It's not the end of the world. But that even as the ancient Republic of Rome became a more imperial structure, the government may have grown so large and the responsibilities so immense that the government will change under the burdens of a modern world and a modern speed. And that, John is hoping to take it back. I'm just a pessimist about whether or not it can be done. It's so large now, it's so immense.
I thought it was your job to rage against this. Just, here you are, Hugh Hewitt, saying, I guess it's over.
I'm just saying the eclipse of the republic is a very real possibility.
As long as he gets to be Augustus Julius, I'm fine
with that. If I've got a pass into the palace, yeah.
I'll be Augustine watching from North Africa with tears in my eyes. So I have to say, as I made notes for this, all my thinking was in terms of what can be done to put this president back in the box. But the two of you have sort of, there's the other possibility here is that one thing that could happen between now and his leaving office is that the Republicans in the House and the Senate get their act. We have executive in the legislative. branch. Yes?
Well, they should have passed a budget already. They should have gone after defense. They should be funding an Ohio-class submarine. They should be funding new aircraft carriers. They haven't done any of this yet. So part of my pessimism about turning it around is that
it appears to be
our lack of talent, and our talent is very junior in the hierarchy of the House and the Senate. Very junior. Now, if a dynamic and extraordinary individual rises up, as President Reagan did in 1980, and can command the Congress, as he did in 81 and 82 and 83, things could change. But, you know, it's really, I think conservatives have to be as pessimistic as they typically are, and William F. Buckley, we'll note it, but I don't think we should be overly optimistic about reversing it.
Okay, last couple of questions here. The press, broadly speaking, the mainstream press has backed Obama and backed this agenda of creeping unilateralism or lawlessness. And broadly speaking, it's been the new alternative media, the Hugh Hewitt Show, Law Talk, John Yoo's podcast, that has been pushing back and pushing back.
Thanks for the plug. I love it.
And pushing back. Fair summation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So what's your, are you optimistic about that balance?
No.
Gosh,
no.
So why doesn't the mainstream media do the decent thing and die? They're irrelevant.
Are they? They're just absolutely irrelevant. This president has proven that the White House press corps is the most toothless. Now, Hillary Gate or Epot Dome or whatever you want, homebrew scandal, whatever it is, shows us that the Washington Post is going after former Secretary of State Clinton with both barrels. I mean, they are really going after this. Because it's maybe there is some recognition that they have abdicated, and they did abdicate for the last 6 years. They have not covered. You're a veteran of the Bush administration. We're veterans of the Reagan administration. We know what a hostile White House press corps does.
Right.
That isn't there. It's gone. And so maybe it will regenerate. But I think it's gotten younger and younger, and the byline has become the brand, and they're less interested in threatening their axis than they are exposing perfidy.
Okay. Final question. Last time I interviewed Justice Scalia, this is about 18 months or so ago, he spoke, as of course few people can, with real love, really, for the Constitution and the constitutional order. And he concluded this beautiful little paragraph with the following words, and I'm quoting him, "We had a good thing here." And then he corrected himself, and he said, "We have a good thing here."
Yeah, past tense.
Well, that's what struck me as well. So 5 years from now, that gets us a few years into the next administration. Where will we be? Will the constitutional order, will the republic be receding in the distance?
Well, I think Scalia gave you exactly a hint of the pessimism I put on the table, which is that I don't know how you can turn this much of a nightmare around. President Obama set out to fundamentally transform America. He has fundamentally transformed America. A Republican who wishes to campaign on fundamentally retransforming it back might have legs. But thus far, no one's actually said that.
John?
I'm much more optimistic, I guess, because I...
Thank goodness, because you always like to end a show on an upbeat, right?
This show's going on for another half hour. What are you talking? I'm just getting started. Maybe it's over. I would not disagree with Hugh probably on all the bad things Obama has done, but what has impressed me over this last 6 years is the robustness of our system, that he has not been able to destroy our system. Look at the Tea Parties, the states coming back up, resistance in Congress. Our system has ways to press back. So I just look at things like, if we're in such bad shape, why is every country in the world asking us for our troops to come back? Why are so many millions of immigrants trying to get into the country? Why is everyone wanting to lend money to us at basically zero interest rates? Our system's not great, but if you look at compared to the rest of the world, we're still the shining city on the hill.
Except with regards to one thing. We do not have Ronald Reagan's 600-ship Navy. We do not have the MX missile. We do not have any military thrust capability remotely what we need for a world that's dangerous.
I agree. We need to rebuild defense. The thing we don't have is a world that's hostile to us, right? We have a world that wants us to build up our defense and to play a leadership role.
The PRC?
Everyone but them. But Japan
and
Korea.
Russia?
But I think
Iran?
That's why we have so many people asking us for us back, is because the last 6 years, that's the real threat. I think we can repair what's going on at home. The problem is, can we repair what President Obama's done abroad, because we've allowed these rivals to rise without any meaningful response.
That's where we agree.
Okay, boys, in 4 years maximum, I'll get the two of you right back at this table, and one of you will be able to look the other in the eye and say, "I told you so."
It's true.
John Yoo, Hugh Hewitt, thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks.
For the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson.